welcome back to Night Vision. Paul, we were talking about podcasts, and technology is a very important part of your book. Can you tell us about Google Earth and its impact on your book?
Okay. Now, one of the things about Tom Corvin is I've tried to set an atmosphere that's almost like old-style storytelling. And because of the way it was delivered, basically I wrote it as I went along and then podcast it immediately after I finished some chapter. So I wrote it in the cafes in Split, and then when I finished, I recorded it onto my MP3 player and then cut it, edited it on my computer. I then delivered it within sometimes hours of finishing that particular chapter. So if you think, it's a little bit like the old style Dickensian storytelling around the fireside. Not only, you've got a little bit of a juxtaposition there between Dickensian storytelling and using 21st century technology. Now that runs in the book itself. And what it seems to be for anyone reading or listening to the podcast, reading the book or listening to the podcast, is that we've got this dark and stormy night story that we've all heard. And when we see ghosts, we automatically jump to the conclusion that these are ghosts. But in this case, in Tom Corvin's case, it's not. Everything that is going on is technology-based. And what I've tried to do is to extrapolate the technology that's going on around us now and put it way into the future. And what we'll find in the future, as things get smaller and smaller, and it's happening now, wires are disappearing, huge systems are now becoming tiny.
Mobile phones, etc., yeah.
Exactly, MP3 players. I mean, a little tiny box now that will hold 10,000 songs. It's just absolutely incredible. So this is going to continue until you get tiny, tiny grains. And effectively, technology could disappear from our eyes and start being integrated into our bodies. That's what's going on in Tom Corvin. Now, the link with Google Earth is a particular chapter in the book.
And can you just set the scene for us of what is going to happen in the next 5 minutes?
Okay, well, Tom Corvin, when the book starts, doesn't know who he is. And through much of the book, he's beginning to discover who he is and what's special about him. In this scene, this is about three quarters of the way through the book, and something nasty has just happened, and he is running to try and stop something even nastier happening. He's going through fields, and he's trying to find a path which leads over a mountain. But it's dark, he's bewildered, although he's beginning to understand what's happening, he's not quite sure. However, he's trapped at this moment that we're about to hear by thorns. And if you just keep Google Earth in your head when you're listening to this and imagine, wind it forward 1,000 years, then hopefully you'll understand what's happening.
Super, super. We're going to listen to that now. Thank you, Paul.
Just on the black sack over his head. It pressed on his face and physically pushed him back so that he had to sway to find his balance. Something, probably a bat, swooped close to his ear. Tom tumbled backwards in fright, his clothes clawed by hooks, 1,000 curved thorns grappling him to the ground, refusing to let him go until they had bled him. When he gained his feet, he cursed the black pit that had swallowed the night. He could no longer see the subtle shades of black outlining the curve of the hill, and the infernal bracken became a malevolent infestation, stinging and stabbing, taunting and clinging. He tried looking askance, as he'd done with the deer so very long ago, but the night was thick and fat and fast, and as impenetrable as the malicious bush gripping him. Stretching his arms, he felt his way ahead, fingers tipping lightly over the dense vegetation. This action, his arms outstretched through the black, reminded him of his experience in the cave. And immediately, on making the connection, Tom sensed a strange glow from everything around him, as though the grass, the trees, the mountains, and the ground itself had suddenly acquired the gift of light.
But Tom recognised the effect. He did not understand how it was happening, but at this point he didn't care. Around him, everywhere, the land turned luminescent. He focused on whatever detail lurched his way, trying to sharpen the effect in his mind. The light was a faint blue, but to his right a hint of green soon formed itself into the strangest-looking tree he had ever seen. It was blurred, deliberately it seemed, as though its maker had yet to decide its exact shape. Around him, the thorns became a smoky brown mass wafting back and forth as though anchored and blown by a shifting slow-mo breeze. He hadn't heard it before, but now the sound of running water gurgled through the brightening scenery. The world he looked on was not some strange sketch, but a tangible reality where, directly in front of him, a kilometre from where he stood, the mountain seemed to drift out of the darkness and present itself to him. The undulating ground to his right, solid and now bright as a day lit from within. Above, a cloudless night sky glittered with black satin sequins. He looked to his left and his heart leapt with sudden excitement. No more than 20 meters away, a ghostly fence cut the ground. To its right, the bloody thorns, to its left, a shaven lawn so massive that Tom knew before he saw the smoky flags that the smooth carpeted landscape was that of a golf course. Ignoring the pain, his shredded clothes, he battled back the way he came, skirted the thorns and made for the fence on easy ground. He stared at the waist-high wire. It ran from fuzzy post to fuzzy post. Tom inched his hand down towards the horizontal line as though expecting the thing to slice his fingers. When he felt nothing at the point of touch, or rather, the point of no touch, the hazy, linear smudge dropped a fraction, repelled it seemed by his skin. He continued chasing the ghostly barrier for a further half hand and then, at last, when he began to think it would sink to the ground, found the solid object he knew had to be there. The line stopped moving, solidified and thinned. He ran his fingers left and right, recognizing the smooth slide of clean wire. The smoky haze continued to coalesce, changing color as it did until the line became unmistakably metallic. Tom stretched one leg and then another over the fence and felt the smooth, cultivated turf under his feet. If he had not been so worried about Catriona and her father, the boy would have cried for joy. Instead, he looked ahead, saw the unmistakable scar running across the hill, and headed as fast as his sanity would let him towards it. Tom was amazed how quickly he became accustomed to the weird environment that surrounded him. He grew bolder with each minute so that when he found a small footbridge crossing a stream, he did not stop to test the platform for safety or even reality, but bounded across the thing in 3 leaping strides. He barely noticed the water flowing from right to left under his feet, its presence highlighted by shimmering eddies, wispy groups of dark and pale blue swirling and bubbling softly towards the sea. At last, after vaulting a high fence, Tom jumped onto a track which, even in the midst of surreality, he immediately recognises the connecting link between road and footpath he remembered from his journey to the village. He picked up his speed and ran and ran and ran. The path should have been easy, but the gift of light soon became a handicap. Although the edges of the trail were defined accurately, the surface was not. It seemed as though a soft blanket of steam hung over the ground, and Tom realised, in a bizarre link with logic, that the map, for want of a better word, did not contain the detail of every rock and stone under his feet. He stumbled as one foot after another landed on one of the thousands of stones and slid or rolled, making Tom fall again and again so that he was forced to slow his run to a jog and then to a crawl. When he reached the saddle summit, he stood on the crest and caught his breath, sweat and blood and mud covering his wretched body. He desperately needed to stop, to recover for just 2 minutes before running down the other side. But he knew too, he could not afford the time. Heart and breath and feet pounding, he careered, almost beyond control, towards his old home. And 15 minutes later, he looked down on Cregan's roof. A confused, emotional mash-up threatened to make him shout for joy, cry in sorrow, and scream an angry challenge to the world to leave her alone. There, in the bright glow of lamplight, standing on the rock, their rock, Catriona peered up the hill, blind to his presence. Tom bolted down the path towards her.
Welcome back to Night Vision. That was Tom Corvin by Paul Story. Brilliant. Paul, can you explain what's going on in that chapter? What we've just heard?
No.
Please.
having a bloody clue. Okay, as I said, if you can relate it to Google Earth, but wind forward 1,000 years, and imagine instead of looking at a computer, the computer is inside you, and it is connected to your brain. Now, I would understand instantly if a lot of people would say, well, yeah, that's science fiction. Well, of course it's science fiction. I write science fiction. Mm. However, this the research that is going to lead to this sort of thing is going on inside our labs now. Okay, but I'll just jump 1,000 years and let's say it's happened. Now, what's happening with Tom Corvin is he has a map inside his head, and that map is constantly updated, not just by what he sees around him and what he feels. Every sense that he feels, smells, touches, updates his map. He's got the map from a database, just much like Google Earth. It pulls in all sorts of photographs and information, and it builds up a picture.
That gets clearer every time that it's updated. And
exactly. Yeah. Now, because this is inside his body, and imagine you've got GPS inside your body as well, global positioning satellite, okay? So everybody can tell where you are. Anyway, so more importantly, he can tell where he is, or his system can tell where he is, even when he doesn't quite know it himself. So that as he turns left and right, the image he sees, he can even close his eyes. And as he turns left and right, this image will play and give him the representation of the map around him as the system sees it. Now, if he then opens his eyes, any information he sees will be superimposed on that. If the system can't quite understand or is not sure of its surroundings, it'll be a little bit fuzzy. So, for instance, the wire, the fence. He goes to the fence, and the system knows there's a fence there, but hasn't got quite enough detail because someone before him hasn't been there and touched the wire. And so he is effectively and inadvertently updating the database. So he goes to the wire, and it's very fuzzy. And as soon as he sees it's fuzzy, that's because it's not quite sure where the wire is. As he puts his hand down, it starts to seem to be repelled from his hand, but it's not repelled at all. All it is his hand is not meeting the wire, so therefore the information must be wrong. So therefore the system now knows it's lower. And as it knows it's lower, it starts to understand a little bit more about his position. So it starts to solidify. So as it goes lower, it starts to look more like a wire rather than a little bit of linear fog. Until he touches it. And as he touches it, the system now knows where it is. So it actually is now a wire, and he sees a wire. And then when he wraps his hand round it, and he slides his hand back and forth, it feels very smooth. And if we've all run a hand along a wire, we know, we can say, that, yeah, that's a metallic wire, or it's a bit of string, yeah, or something like that. And again, the system is updated.
It becomes defined.
And, exactly.
And it is what it is. Excellent. So what's in store for you now? Where do you go from here?
Okay, well, now I've finished the novel, what I should do is
take a holiday.
this is a holiday. It's brilliant. What a great life. No, what I should do is take it to agents and publishers. But I'm in a slightly unusual position. When I came here, it was a lot of it was to do with finances, because I left a very good job. I was an officer in the Air Force in Britain, and I decided just to chuck it all in because I am going to be a writer. Because I didn't have any money, I had to live in a tent, and lived there for 4 months. In fact, I lived in a tent for 4 months where Tom Corvin is set, and I wrote my last novel, which is 10 Downing Street. The problem is that the rules for submitting to agents and publishers are very defined. You have to print out your novel. It's huge. You've only got to do it one-sided on the paper. It's got to be double-spaced, so it's like four times the pages.
Very traditional.
Exactly. Yeah. This is designed about 100 years ago, and they're still doing it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just didn't want to go down that route, which, of course, means that probably no one will ever hear of this. But anyway, I have a cunning plan. But, of course, that's all very well. How do people know it exists? So, the next step in the project is that I'm about to leave Split in about 2 or 3 days, and I'm going back to the UK, and I'm selling Tom Corvin as the world's most expensive novel.
How much is that?
Well, dig into your pockets, folks. This is $500 per copy. This sounds a bit expensive, and of course it is, and you would be quite right to assume that I'm crazy. But there is an alternative. You can, in fact, buy it for $6.25 as an ebook, or, in fact, as a print version. I'm not really selling the novel at this stage. What I'm selling is shares in myself. If you buy this special edition of Tom Corvin for $500, then you will have a share in everything I earn for the rest of my life, or until I pay you back 10 times the original price of the novel. And in doing this, one, I intend to attract a publisher, but although I may attract a publisher, it could be that I don't get the deal that will suit my backers, because of course I've got to pay back my backers. And if that's the case, then I'll take the money I've raised, start up a publishing company myself, and publish it through that company.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And one other thing is, the people who do give you this money, they get a page dedicated to themselves.
Yes, that's true. Every single novel sold in stores around the world, on Amazon, and held in libraries around the world, will have a page dedicated to anyone who buys this special edition copy for $500. Now, so far, I've sold 10 copies. I've only been going just over a week, and so far raised $5,000. I'm now going over to Britain to take it out of a soft launch, where I've basically written to family and friends. I sold 5 that way through family and friends, and 5 from total strangers who just love the podcast. Now I'm taking it wider and taking it to yourselves, and thanks for allowing me to talk to your listeners.
It's good to have you here. This is the history in the making, very, very possibly. It's a fantastic concept.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate that. And fingers crossed, if the media and the public are interested in what I'm doing and get behind me, then this is going to work.
I've just read the first 16, 17 chapters of 10 Downing Street, and if it's anything like that, it will work. It sounds fantastic.
Thanks, Stephen. I really appreciate
it. We wish you the very best of luck, and hope to see you back here soon, or, well, after your 7th or 8th book, maybe.
I will be back. I love it here.
It is amazing. Just to finish off, we'll play another of your chosen tracks, and this is from, I think, Vangelis?
Yeah, Vangelis.
Vangelis.
who's right? I think it's Vangelis.
Yeah. That's how you say it in Scotland.
and this is the theme from the movie Bitter Moon.